Inside Alan Wood is the story of Giles Darby, a former British banker who was extradited and jailed on account of his entanglement in a $7 million wire fraud case. They were branded, Giles and his co-defendants, the Nat West Three, and became the subject of, I think you'll remember, extensive media coverage. Delighted to welcome Giles to the show. Morning, sir.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Nice to talk to you, Giles. Probably people are not familiar with your name, but I think there can't be many that don't remember the Nat West 3 as a thing.
Well, you have to be of a certain vintage, don't you, by now?
Yes, absolutely. They certainly do. Let's talk about how this all started before we get to, you know, the reasons for the book and the main kind of thrust of that. The reason you were called the Nat West Three is because the three of you worked at Greenwich Nat West. Now, that wasn't what we would call a normal banking branch, was it?
No, it was an investment bank. Essentially, investment banks put two sides of a deal together and act as the middleman, and that's what we did.
And I imagine when you joined that particular sector of banking, you would have had no clue as to what the future would hold for you, sir.
Well, crikey, I joined that best as a boy in 1980, amazingly.
Wow.
And then ended up working my way through different departments and ended up in the investment bank. More by sort of good luck than good judgment, and just got very lucky in terms of the job I did. And so when I started out in the bank, I had no clue that I would end up investment banking.
Yeah.
But it was a wonderful job. It is a wonderful job. It's not for the faint-hearted. It's very hard work. It's enjoyable if you enjoy putting deals together and putting customers together. It's really enjoyable. I work with lots of very, very good, fun people. And at the time this all happened to us, we were thoroughly enjoying life at the time.
Yeah. Was it a kind of a mini version of the Wolf of Wall Street, or at the time, or was it not quite that glamorous?
Well, my wife keeps asking me that. But we didn't quite go to his length, put it that way. We had lots of fun, but not some of the things.
Fair enough.
Some of the stuff he did, we didn't do. So
fair enough.
Good fun.
Now, your organisation's, I guess, most important relationship was with Enron, and that's a name which, again, people probably don't know who they are. What they did, but they know the name.
Well, interestingly enough, at that time, I was running the global energy group in the bank, and so we actually had offices all over the world. We had 15 offices all over the world,
right,
including one in Moscow. And Gary Mulgrew, who is a great friend of mine, was then, still is now, and was my boss at the time. I used to say to him, "Look, these Russians, we've got these guys are difficult to deal with, and we could end up in problems with these Russians." But you know what?
Wow.
We never expected the problems we ended up having to come from the Americans.
Wow.
So Enron was a large American energy company at the time, very aggressive company, full of entrepreneurial people who were all motivated by stock price. They were all basically given stock as reward for the jobs they did and shares in the company, and they were all highly motivated by the share price and the stock price. And so they did lots and lots of financial transactions all over the world, and we were one of their, over a period of time, we became one of their main banks. And Gary and myself, in particular, became very friendly with their chief financial people, a guy called Andy Faster, was a CFO.
Yep.
His sidekick, Michael Copper, and the whole financial team, a guy called Paul Chivers here in Europe. We were all similar ages, and we became very good friends, and we did lots of business together. And we never for a minute expected we would end up in the problems that we had working with them.
Fasto's an interesting one to bring up, because I get from the book that he was very much more a kind of Wolf of Wall Street guy. He was, you know, CFO of America's hotshot company. He's 36. He's an Ivy League guy. He's got nice teeth and nice hair and shakes your hand properly. So he's a kind of different kind of animal, I would think.
Yeah, and unbelievably aggressive, very, very smart, very, very intelligent. He himself is married to an heiress himself. So he, but he was the guy that kind of sat in Enron, pulled all the strings on the finance side. And we never for a minute thought we would end up in the situation we ended up through doing business with him. We just never had even considered it.
Amazing. Now, tell us about what was going on in your kind of banking world at that time. It was the turn of the millennium, and I think I'm right in saying that NatWest was fighting some rather hostile takeover bids then.
That's right. So NatWest was... there were a couple of different bids for NatWest at the time. One was Bank of Scotland, one was Royal Bank of Scotland, and our bosses at Greenwich NatWest were trying to position Greenwich for its best possible outcome. And Gary was one of the senior guys in the bank, and he was heavily involved in what was going on. And so we were working quite hard at the time to keep our business together, because obviously when you're under a threat of a hostile takeover, you have no clue what's going to happen to your business. So at the time, we were working hard to keep our group together and keep our business together. And Fasto knew that. And one of the challenges we had was what were we going to do? You know, did we want to work for another clearing bank, as it were?
Yep.
There's different clearing bank has a different culture to it. At the time, it had a different culture to an investment bank. The clearing bank is very straightforward business, whereas a investment bank is much more entrepreneurial.
Right. And I get the impression that you guys could have been kind of, taken over wholesalely as a team, right?
It was possible. But what we weren't clear about is what was the culture of the people who were taking us over.
Yeah.
So we wanted to return. We had a very, very dynamic entrepreneurial culture in Greenwich, and we wanted to retain that culture in our group. And obviously the ability to be able to do that, we focused on the ability to keep doing the deals we were doing with our customer base. And so Gary and I and David, the third guy, we paid a trip to Houston to go and see various customers, Houston, Texas, where Enron was based. We paid a trip to go to see various customers, including Andy, to talk about if we moved businesses, would we still be able to transact with them?
Yes.
And Mr. Fasto was very happy to keep doing business with us. So we kind of went to the meeting, went for dinner, and went our sweet way afterwards. But Andy subsequently contacted Gary and said, look, if you guys are moving, I've got a transaction that we can put together. Would you guys be interested in doing something separate to the bank?
And
we said, yes, we would, because we knew that we would be on a short-term period of leave, and therefore we'd be able to do something privately.
That's what
transpired.
Yeah, so this deal, I think I'm right in saying, to kind of bring it down to its basics, involved you recommending to NatWest that it sells a stake it owned in an offshore investment vehicle, which are called SwapSub, for $1 million, without informing them who was buying it. And that was a company controlled by you, and you put up your own money, I believe, for the purchase.
That's a nice summary. The one bit you got wrong is we didn't know we were buying it ourselves.
Right. Okay.
So what happened was that Fasto came to us and said, look, you've got this package of assets. Do you want to sell it? The assets had a mathematical value because they're based on a share price and time value of money. Ergo, they have a mathematical value. The mathematical value was extremely volatile, and at the time we were offered $1 million, the actual mathematical value was negative.
Uh-huh.
So to get $1 million was a good deal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just one more thing, it's very important. So I went and then discussed that with one of the senior executives in the bank, and he gave his approval for the transaction.
Crucially,
We then sold the deal, sold the transaction, only to subsequently find later that we had invested on the other side via Andy and Fasto without knowing what we'd invested in. Now, where we went wrong, the error we made, is at that point we should have divulge to our employers that we had bought the transaction on the other side of the deal. But we were leaving the bank, and we had advice that we had taken an option to invest, and that an option wasn't disclosable.
Right.
And that's where we went wrong. All right. That's the bit that got us into trouble. We didn't disclose the option because we didn't believe we were required to. However, when some years later, the Feds tried to put everything together, they basically accused us of knowingly having committed a fraud by knowingly underselling the asset on the one side and knowingly having invested on the other side. And their allegations were that we knew what we were doing all along.
Right. And the numbers involved in that, just for those who don't remember, Fasto persuaded Enron to buy the stake, I think, for $20 million. And when that deal went through, he did rather well. He and a colleague pocketed $12.3 million between them, while you guys, between the three of you, I think, shared $7.35 million. Is that correct numbers?
Yeah, again, you're nearly right. It's actually $30
million. Okay.
But he paid CSF Credit Suisse Boston $10
million. Yeah.
He paid NatWest $1 million, and he kept $19 million back, and he paid him and his partners $12 million, and David, Gary, and myself $7
million. Right.
So that's what happened. Now, the question then became, and David Birmingham is one of the other two guys wrote a book. In his book, he spends a lot of time talking about the question is not why did we get one, but the real question was why did Credit Suisse get 10? That was the real question, right?
Yeah.
And David's book goes into it in a lot of detail. So I'm really impressed. It's a complicated thing that happened.
It is.
You've picked it up. Outstanding. Well done. Really impressed.
Thank you. It is complicated. So as you say there, basically, you were effectively, and your other two chums were said to have undersold the swap stub stake. You had conspired with Fasto, that was the thing, to defraud Enron, and that was what the whole kind of thing was based on. Were you guilty of breaching NatWest's internal compliance rules or not?
Yeah, good questions, all of them, right? So the Department of Justice, when they extradited us and then charged us, said that we had knowingly conspired with Mr. Fasto to commit fraud.
Mm.
When we fought the case, and we fought the case incredibly hard, to have committed fraud, you have to have knowingly committed the act, okay?
Yeah.
We were able to demonstrate, and to be fair to Andy, he also, in his testimony, said that we had no idea what he had done. So he told the Feds himself that he didn't tell us what he was doing. So that's number one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Number two, we were able to prove mathematically the value of the asset, that it was negative when we sold it. Number three, when we finally did the plea agreement with the Feds, the argument became, well, what did you do wrong?
Because
when you do a plea agreement, you have to do something called a statement of facts,
yep.
Which is it's publicly available on the internet. And in the statement of facts, we argued long and hard about what did we do wrong, because the statement of facts has to be the truth.
Yep.
And we hadn't knowingly defrauded anybody of anything. So where we ended up was what you and you got it in one, is we breached the compliance guidelines at NatWest. That's what we ended up pleading guilty to.
Right. Okay.
So again, you got right to the nub of it. Never. Well done again.
Bless you. And I believe that that's known as a theft of opportunity. Is that correct?
Well, under the US guidelines, it's called a theft of honest services.
Right.
But for there to have been theft of honest services, there had to be a monetary value.
Yeah.
And our argument was all along was, what's the monetary value on an option? If you exercise an option in something, you might or you might not make money. And you had to, for it to be a crime, you had to know you're going to make money, and we didn't. So again, the statement of facts is very, very clear. It's about six pages. In fact, as I told the judge, when the judge when we had to go to court and plead guilty, the judge said to us, so he started with me for some reason, so Mr. Darby, you knowingly committed fraud on Enron. I said, no, Your Honour, that's not what happened. And I had to direct him to the paragraph in the statement of facts, page 3, paragraph 22, and they can never forget it, to explain what had happened, and it was a breach of our compliance regulations at NatWest.
You took the plea bargain when you could have fought the case. Now, what was the reason for that? Was it because you had trouble getting witnesses to back up your story?
Okay, all right, so here's a question for you, okay? If you know that you go to court and you're facing 35 years, which is what it was, right? So on the one hand, you might go to court and you might lose and you might get a very, very long time, a life-ending sentence. That's one option.
Mm.
Another option is to fight it and you might win.
Yeah.
You might win, okay?
Yeah.
Or the other option is you can do a deal and you can actually get it all over in a few months. Then I think most people on the planet would take the option of don't roll the dice, take a few months and get it all over with.
Yes.
And that's what we ended up doing. I mean, it's a little known fact that in the States, in the federal system in the States, there are two systems, state systems, so interstate crime or federal, which is across states. So federal is multi-state crime.
Yep.
And this is federal. In the federal system in the States, 99.3% of all the people indicted do a plea bargain. 99.3%. And the reason for that is that the sentences and the penalties involved for committing a crime are so large that you'd have to have, excuse the phrase, but you'd have to have balls of steel.
Yes.
To go to court in America. Balls
Absolutely.
Of steel.
Yeah, get it. It's worth pointing out here that you, I think I'm correct in saying, told the FSA, the Financial Services Authority, that you thought that you may have been involved in a fraudulent transaction. And is it an urban myth that you heard nothing more until you heard it on breakfast television?
That's correct. So when Enron collapsed, they fired Fasto and his whole finance team, and they made a declaration to the authorities in America that there had been some illegal activity. We read about it. It was the first we knew of any fraudulent activity. We told our employers. We then went to tell the FSA, and they said, and we were in an interview with them for 5 or 6 hours. It was all transcribed, and they asked if they could send it to the American authorities. We said, of course, no problem. We had nothing to hide. Yep, absolutely no problem. Go ahead. We heard nothing. Our lawyers heard nothing. We heard nothing. And then 7 months later, I was staying with a friend down in Bath, where I live, and we'd had a couple of beers, and I was lying in bed at 7 in the morning. His wife knocked on the door and said, Giles, you need to get up. I said, why? Because you're on breakfast telly.
Goodness.
And I literally wandered into their front room, and their headlines on breakfast TV all morning were that three of us had been indicted and were facing 35 years in prison.
Goodness me.
That's how we found out.
Now, you fought extradition on the grounds that you wouldn't receive a fair trial in the US, and it was a fair point because you were alleged to have defrauded one of the largest financial institutions in Britain. You're British, you were living and working in Britain when it happened, and it's a British case, but there you are being sent off to the US, and that must have been a bit of a nightmare for you.
Our thing was, I mean, if you imagine, we all along, we fought this thing incredibly hard. So, right at the start, when after the breakfast telly, we got over the shock of what had happened. Within a couple of months, I had to hire an American lawyer at vast expense, and he went to see the DOJ in Washington, and the DOJ, Department of Justice, American Department of Justice, the DOJ. The DOJ said, my lawyer said, what do you guys want? And they said, well, tell him to plead guilty and to cooperate against all the Enron people, and we'll go soft on him. He probably won't have to go to jail, might have to pay some money back, and we won't be hard. And he phoned me up, and he said, look, if you plead guilty, is what will happen. I said, but I'm not guilty. But I didn't do it. So how do I plead guilty to something I didn't do?
Yeah.
And that was the start of everything. I mean, at that point, the die is cast. And again, we didn't then hear anything for maybe a couple of years.
Right.
Time went by, everyone went about their everyday life. And then eventually we got arrested and picked up. What had happened is that Michael Copper, who was Andy Fasto's right-hand man, had then turned evidence, and he was cooperating with the feds, and that led to us being indicted and extradited sometime later.
Yes.
So, yeah, that took 4 years, that whole thing, 2002 to 2006.
Goodness me. Eventually, you were sentenced to 37 months in prison, originally in the United States, but you subsequently went back to UK prisons to serve your sentences a little later on. You were sent to three different prisons, weren't you, I think, at the time?
Well, okay, right, you skipped a whole important
thing. I know I have, but we're going to run out of time and get, because the book
I
is mainly.
You that, yeah. I started the whole thing. Let me say this to you, right, real quick. We fought the whole thing. We fought a tough defence, and we did it on the basis that we knew we didn't do this, and so therefore we had to demonstrate to the prosecutors that we didn't do it, okay?
Yeah.
They handed us, erroneously from their point of view, they handed us a bunch of phone tapes.
Right.
That had been taped when we were at the bank. When we transcribed the tapes, they showed beyond any reasonable doubt that we had no idea what was going on and no clue what was going on. We transcribed them, we sent them to the feds, and they kind of figured that they dropped a ball by giving us all the paperwork, and they then said, okay, what do we do? How do we get everybody out of this? What shall we do? And so we said, well, look, we want to get it over with. We're all in our mid-40s.
Yeah,
I wanted it over by the time I was 50. What we will do 12 months in prison, all right?
Right.
And so they then said, right, well, 12 months isn't long enough. You've got to do longer than that. It's politically sensitive. What we'll do is we will agree to send you straight back to the UK when you get into a US prison, but it will take a few months.
Right.
So eventually what happened is we agreed 37 months, knowing that we would go back to the UK fairly quickly. Well, I ended up going back to the UK within 8 months. In the UK, everything gets halved for good time. So we ended up doing about 17, 18 months in the end. That's what happened.
Got it. And the book, then, Inside Alan Wood, is fascinating because it's really in a kind of an appraisal of the American justice system and how you manage to, you know, and keep your health and your sanity intact. Coming out the other side of this, and I know I'm jumping again here, you know, on release, how did your life change? What did people view you very differently? Because you had been very high profile, hadn't you? And the press had not been absolutely kind to you.
No, I agree. Gary, again, one thing before we went inside, one of the things he said to me was, look, make sure that when you come out, you retain your health and you retain your sanity.
Yeah.
We can all, with our health and our sanity, we can come back, all right?
Yeah.
So when we came out, what was really, really interesting is that over the period of the years that had gone by, because it was now, when we came out, it was 2010, it started in 2002, so 8 years had gone by. We had unbelievable help and support from many, many friends, ex-colleagues, but just people that we'd known over the years.
Yeah.
We had massive support and massive help. We would never have got through it without any of that. There's no doubt about it. And so then when we came out, I didn't have a stigma. I don't think the other two guys did, because I knew I hadn't done anything wrong and I'd been completely stitched up. That's how I felt. I felt it then. I feel it now. Hasn't changed. But because I'm an optimist and positive about everything in my life, I just said, right, I'm going to get on with this, I'm going to rebuild my life, and I'm going to come back from where I was. Yeah. And so with the help and support of lots of people, we've been able to do that. That was the attitude I had.
Wow. And where are we now then, Giles? What's your kind of... I know we've had a dreadful year, all of us, in the last 14 months or so, but what form does your life now take?
Well, I'm extremely happily married to a lovely lady. I've been with her 10 years.
Fantastic.
I have 5 wonderful daughters, 10 incredible grandchildren.
Wow.
And I've rebuilt my business life. I now own a chain of small chain of pubs and hotels all along the South Wales, going all the way up from Bristol down to Swansea. And obviously, yes, you're right. The last year has been horrendous.
Yeah, particularly in that game, of course, yeah.
Well, economically, yeah, we've been closed for 10 months out of 13.
Oof.
It's been tough. But look, again, I've met some amazing people, really, really good people, that have helped and supported what I do. Very, very lucky to have met all of them. And so we've got through it. We've reopened all our pubs in Wales this Monday. Everything's open again, and we are looking forward to trading and building the business. So that's what we do.
Well, fair play. Inside Alan Wood is the name of the book. Giles Darby, yes, we took up 25 minutes there, and we still didn't really touch the surface of a lot of it.
I told you at the start, you wouldn't.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you, sir. It's all in the book for people who want to find out the details that we had to skip. But
Thank you.
Great to talk to you, Giles. All the best for the future. You take care.
All right.
All right. Cheers and bye-bye.